Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Russian Empire History Podcast, the history of all the peoples of the Russian Empire. I'm your host, J.P. Bristow. This is Season 1, The Forest, The Steppe, and The Birth of the Russian Empire, Episode 5, The Bosporan Kingdom. Quick note to start with, there were two groupings of Greek inhabitants in the Russian Empire and its successor states. The second group, known as the Caucasian Greeks, came later from the Byzantine Empire. Today we're going to be talking about the first group, the Greek colonies of the North Black Sea shore, that would eventually become the Bosporan Kingdom, and the people who would later be known as the Pontic Greeks. The Caucasian Greeks will come into our story at a later point. Our story begins in Miletus, a city on the Anatolian Peninsula, a few hundred years before the Greek Golden Age. Miletus was first settled before 3000 BCE, with archaeological finds in the city suggesting that there was an influx of Cretans from around 1900 BCE. By the middle of the second millennium, Miletus was a Mycenaean outpost in Asia Minor, engaged in regular skirmishes with the Hittites. In the Iliad, Homer has Miletus as an ally of Troy. In the Great Bronze Age collapse, the Sea Peoples burned the city, but it emerged from the Greek Dark Ages as one of the 12 city-states to found the Ionian League. Miletus was a city of considerable prominence in the Archaic period. It can claim to be the birthplace of Greek philosophy. Thales of Miletus lived from around 623 BCE to 545 BCE. Aristotle declared that he was the first Greek philosopher, and he is accepted by historians as the first person in Western civilization to pursue scientific philosophy. Thales tried to explain natural phenomena through naturalistic theories rather than mythology, and was followed by other philosophers known as the pre-Socratic philosophers. One of his theories was that the earth is floating in water and earthquakes are caused by waves. He was more successful in mathematics, where he was the first to formulate a number of ideas that you're sure to have covered at school, such as the idea that a diameter is a straight line from one side of a circle to another passing through the center, that the angles at the base of an isosceles triangle are equal, and that where two straight lines intersect, the opposite angles are equal, which, along with other ideas, are all attributed to him. Thales was succeeded by the important philosophers Anaximander and Anaximenes. And if you're interested in learning more about the Milesian contribution to ancient philosophy, and why wouldn't you be, I recommend listening to the History of Philosophy Without Any Gaps podcast, which appropriately enough starts off right from Thales in episode 1. Many Greek states had limited fertile land available for food production, and forest clearance, goat herding, and olive cultivation often led to significant erosion, further reducing their resources. This meant that any increase in population immediately put pressure on the food supply, and in response, they returned to colonization, with even smaller cities sending out expeditions to plant daughter cities across the sea. Miletus was especially active in this field, founding more colonies than any other Greek city. Pliny mentions more than 90 colonies that Miletus founded, but of particular interest to us are the colonies it founded on the north shore of the Black Sea. As well as opening up new areas to farming and producing foodstuffs that could be traded back to the parent city, these colonies also engaged with the indigenous population, often intermingling with them to create a new, mixed population, opening whole new areas to trade and spreading Greek culture, ideas, and goods in return. People further inland would trade various raw materials metals, furs, and of course, slaves, to the Greeks, who would use their superior technology to produce manufactured goods and then sell them back again. Successful colonies would also often become prestige-conferring, desired allies of local powers, as well as trading partners. The Greeks founded two kinds of colony. Apoikai were cities settled by citizens from the mother city-state, the equivalent of the city-states in the Greek heartland, while emporia were entrepôts or simple trading stations. Miletus and other cities founded both kinds of colony across the northern Black Sea coast. The first colonies on the northern shores of the Black Sea were established in the 7th century at Histria, by the mouth of the Danube, and at Berezan, a small island in the Dnieper estuary. These were trading towns with no attached land, but in the late 500s, settlers moved in to farm. Sometimes one trading outpost would be abandoned in order to move into one of the new settlements, as happened at Berezan, which was abandoned after Olbia was established on the coast a short distance away. The Taman and Kerch peninsulas proved particularly attractive. These two peninsulas face each other where the Kerch Bridge now runs from the Russian mainland to Crimea. The Kerch Peninsula is on the Crimean side, and the Taman Peninsula is on the mainland. The strait between them joins the Black Sea and the Sea of Azov, which the Greeks called Lake Myotis, and was then known as the Cimmerian Bosphorus, from which the Bosporan Kingdom was to take its name. A further wave of immigration came in the mid-6th century, as the expansion of the Persian Empire disrupted Greek cities in Anatolia. Greek cities would soon cover the northern shore of the Black Sea and the Azov Sea, and population growth was strong enough for these colonies to move on to start planting their own colonies. The colonies in Crimea included Theodosia, founded in the 6th century BCE and a major agricultural center, Panticapaeum, founded in the 6th century BCE, stood on the site now occupied by Kerch, and was also a major agricultural center. Grain from Crimea, which the Greeks called taurika, was the main competitor for Egyptian grain, and was traded throughout the Mediterranean. Around 40 kilometers south of Panticapaeum, Chimericon was founded in the 5th century BC. And became the most important city in the region. It was a strong fortress with city walls 2.5 meters thick that remained impregnable until it was sacked by the Goths in the mid-3rd century CE. Hersonius was founded by Heraclea Pontica on the southwest of the Crimean Peninsula, standing just outside where the modern city of Sevastopol is today. Of course, the Pontic Steppe and the Crimean Peninsula were not empty when the Greeks arrived. A people called the Cimmerians are believed to have occupied the steppe. As yet, there are no archaeological finds associated with them, but they are found in records elsewhere. They may have been Iranian or Thracian-speaking, and they originated somewhere between the Danube and the Volga. According to Herodotus, they were driven out of their homeland by the westward migrating Scythians and displaced west and south into the Caucasus and Anatolia. They may have enlisted with Assyria's Sargon II to conquer Urartu. They appear to have defeated Lydia, which struck fear into the Greek cities of Anatolia. But after major defeats over the next couple of decades, they fade out of history altogether. The inner mountains of Crimea were inhabited by the Tauri, for whom it was named Taurica. The Tauri were legendarily savaged, and lived by raiding and piracy until well into the Roman era. According to Herodotus, they worshipped a virgin goddess and captured Greek travelers to sacrifice, first clubbing them, then removing the head, throwing the body off a cliff, and finally nailing the head to a cross. By the 5th century, Miletus had been laid waste in the disastrous Ionian revolt against the Persians, and Scythian tribes were making regular demands for tribute from the increasingly rich Greek cities. In response, a group of cities in eastern Crimea and on the Taman Peninsula, led by Chimericon, came together under Artianax to form the Bosporan Kingdom, or Kingdom of the Cimmerian Bosporus. This kingdom was perhaps the first Hellenized state. That is, its population was only partially Greek, with Scythians, Taurians, Thracians, and others making up the rest, but it was culturally within the Greek world. Following the death of Alexander the Great, other Hellenized kingdoms would form across the lands that he had conquered as Greek culture became preeminent from the eastern Mediterranean to Central Asia. With sufficient strength in numbers to secure themselves against the Scythians militarily, the Bosporan Kingdom was soon reaping the rewards of its position. The Crimean colonies had a fertile hinterland that was soon the breadbasket for other Greek Black Sea colonies and city-states in the Aegean, while the bountiful fish of the Azov Sea, easy to catch in its shallow waters, were salted and also exported. The Bosporan Kingdom grew rich under the Archaeonactidae dynasty, but not for long. 40 years after it was established, in 438, the Archaeonactid tyrant was gone, deposed, killed, or just died, no one really knows. Whatever the truth of the matter, he was succeeded by a man called Spartacus. Spartacus was almost certainly from the powerful Odrysian kingdom on the Black Sea's western shore, around where Bulgaria is today. And the dynasty that he founded would be highly successful, ruling for 328 years and dramatically expanding the Bosporan Kingdom. The dynasty that Spartacus founded was called the Spartacids, and under their leadership, the Bosporan Kingdom expanded from the shores of the strait further into Crimea, east across the Black Sea, and north around the shores of Lake Maeotis. The economy boomed as it took over already powerful trading ports at Nymphaeum, Theodosia, and Gorgippa, and extended its holdings of fertile agricultural land. Back in Greece, Athens was a burgeoning power with a population that was rapidly outstripping its ability to produce food. Grain imports from the Bosporan Kingdom began in the second half of the 5th century BCE and increased steadily over the next century. Athens became highly dependent on Bosporan grain, while the Spartacid kings were equally dependent on the enormous profit that the grain trade generated to maintain their position. Athens went out of its way to keep the Spartacids happy, granting them honorary titles such as Benefactor of Athens and Athenian citizenship, and erecting statues of the Spartacid kings in the city's public places. The Athenian trade funded the Bosporan Kingdom's military, paying for Greek, Scythian, and Thracian mercenaries, and it continued its expansion along the eastern shore of Lake Maeotis. Its good luck could not continue forever, though. In 310 BCE, Bosporan King Pherecydes died following a highly successful 38-year reign, leaving 3 sons behind him. As was so often the case, the brothers had differing views of the succession. Pherecydes had designated his eldest son, Satyrus, as heir, and the middle son, Prytanis, accepted his place and gave him full support. But the youngest son, Eumelos, had no intention of serving anyone. He wanted the kingdom for himself. He decided to seek allies with the Bosporan Kingdom's eastern neighbor, Sarmatian rivals of the Scythians and Thracians that made up his brother's armies. The Syracian king, Aryphanes, was only too glad to receive an opportunity to gain influence over his wealthy neighbour, and raised a massive army of supposedly 22,000 foot soldiers and 20,000 cavalry to go to war. If you're at all familiar with the ancient military history, you'll know that these kinds of numbers should not be taken at face value. Just take it to mean that it was an impressively large army. Satyrus raised his army of 34,000 Scythians, Thracians, and Greek hoplites, and the two forces were soon facing each other on the banks of the river Thatis. The battle opened with Eumelos charging the right side of Satyrus' line, while Satyrus saw that Aryphanes had taken the centre and launched a cavalry charge against him there. The Saracen line crumbled under the fierce attack of the Bosporan Scythians, broke, and fled. But Satyrus was unable to pursue and crush the Saracens completely because Eumelos' charge was proving equally successful. Satyrus' mercenaries lost their nerve and were abandoning the field, and Eumelos was driving through the right wing to threaten the whole line. Satyrus returned with a devastating charge into the flank of Eumelos' cavalry, and the Saracens were routed. Satyrus had won the battle, but not yet the war, as Eumelos and Aryphanes survived the fight another day. The Saracens retreated to Cyrasena, their capital, on an island in the Thatis marshes. The capital was well protected. The only access points were the main entrance or through a swamp behind the city, which was protected by a palisade. All the other approaches were protected by the depth of the river and imposing cliffs. Siege warfare was not really developed at this point in history. You could try to climb the walls or set fire to wooden walls, but people hadn't figured out how to undermine and breach walls or any other way to get in. Satyrus attacked the main entrance with little result other than getting his men killed. But he had guessed that that would be the case and only ordered the attack as a distraction. He had actually sent part of his army around to the swamp to sneak through an attack from the rear. With Aryphanes' men off dealing with the attack on the main gates, the attackers swarmed the palisade, destroying it and opening the island to the Bosporan enemy. Eumelos and Aryphanes retreated into a citadel surrounded by a dense forest. Although Satyrus was now able to bring his army across to the island, the density of the forest meant that he was not able to come against the citadel in force. So he ordered his soldiers to fell the trees and cut a path through. The Saracens did not just sit in the citadel watching. Archers slipped out into the forest. Hiding among the trees, they wreaked havoc among the Bosporan soldiers. But they could not stop the inevitable, and after 4 days, the Bosporans had cut their way through to the wall. The Bosporans launched an attack on the citadel, but it seems like they must have been exhausted from all the logging and archery. The Saracens sallied out in force, and it looked as if they would win the day. Satyrus threw himself into the fray to inspire his men to victory. And here we have one of those cryptic ancient Greek prophecies. According to the Greek historian Diodorus Siculus, Satyrus had been told to be on his guard against the mouse, lest it sometime cause his death. As you might expect in a case like this, this had caused Satyrus to fear mice all his life. But as was always the way with these Greek prophecies, the meaning was not what it seemed at first glance. The mouse was also what the Greeks called the biceps. And what would you know? As Satyrus leapt to the front of the attack, he took a spear through the arm, leaving him to bleed out and die. He had been king for just 9 months. Eumelos had won the battle, and the siege was lifted, but the war was still not over. His middle brother, Prytanis, still had no intention of accepting the younger brother's kingship. With Prytanis gathering forces in Pantikapeum, Eumelos began moving against the smaller cities, capturing them one after another. When the showdown finally came, Prytanis was defeated and fled along the shores of Lake Moesia. Run down and cornered by Eumelus, he submitted, handed over the crown, and acknowledged his brother as king. But even that was not quite the end. Upon returning to Pantikapeum, Prytanis decided to appeal to the people and declare himself Satyrus' rightful heir. Sadly for him, it turned out that the people didn't like him as much as he had hoped. They failed to respond, and as he fled across the Cimmerian Strait, Prytanis was slain. The civil war was over, and Eumelos was king. Eumelos soon proved his victory was no fluke. Over the next 5 years, he built up the Bosporan navy, eradicated piracy in the Black Sea, and established dominance of marine trade. On land, he conquered neighboring Scythians and made the Bosporan kingdom the most powerful state north of the Black Sea. But what would you know, there was also a prophecy about Eumelos. Eumelos' prophecy told him to be on guard against a house that moves. According to Diodorus Siculus, he would never enter a house until his servants had checked the foundations to make sure it was fixed in place. You would think that at some point these ancient Greeks would have noticed the pattern that the thing referred to in the prophecy was never literally the thing referred to in the prophecy, but it seems like they never did. Anyway, Eumelos was riding in his carriage to conduct a sacrifice at the temple. Something startled the horses, and they ran out of control. Afraid to crash and die, Eumelos leapt from his house on wheels to escape. But his sword caught in the wheel, and he was dragged along the ground until he was dead. His death marked the end of the Bosporan kingdom's rise. Alexander the Great's successors had settled their differences for now, and new rivals were emerging. Lysimachus' kingdom on the southern and western shores of the Black Sea became the dominant power in the region, while in Egypt, Ptolemy was building the new breadbasket of the Mediterranean and bringing Bosporan trade supremacy to an end. Over the coming decades, the Bosporan kingdom experienced increasing trouble dealing with Scythian incursions and sought assistance from the King Mithridates of Pontus, a neighboring Hellenistic kingdom extending from Cappadocia round the east coast of the Black Sea. Although initially successful, this subsequently led to a gradual loss of independence, and so the Bosporan kingdom was eventually incorporated into the Kingdom of Pontus. After the Kingdom of Pontus was defeated by Pompey, it became a Roman client state until it was overrun by the Huns in the mid-4th century. Now, I have mentioned Herodotus a couple of times, and I'm sure that many, if not most of you listening to a history podcast, will be familiar with who he is. But since he is going to be very important to our next couple of episodes, I will just give him a quick introduction for anyone who's not sure. Herodotus was born in Halicarnassus, now Bodrum, in southern Turkey, in the 5th century BCE, into a wealthy family. His family was opposed to the Persian takeover of the region and went into exile on Samos. In his youth, Herodotus returned to Halicarnassus to unsuccessfully fight the Persians and then became a traveler. He gathered stories, myths, legends, noted down what he observed, and returned periodically to Athens, where speeches he gave on his travels made him a minor celebrity. He put the information he had gathered together into a work called The Histories, describing the origins and rise of the Persians and the Persian War with the Greeks. The word history originally meant research, and it's from Herodotus' use of it that we derived the meaning we use today, which has earned him the title of the first historian. Herodotus began his work by stating, quote, "Here is the account of the inquiry of Herodotus of Halicarnassus, in order that the deeds of men not be erased by time, and that the great and miraculous works, both of the Greeks and the barbarians, not go unrecorded." End quote. Among the places Herodotus visited were the Greek colonies on the Black Sea north coast. In particular, he spent some time in Olbia. As a result of this stay, the histories contains quite an extensive description of the Greeks' neighbours on the steppe, the first contemporary written descriptions of their lives that we know of. He described the Scythians' lifestyle and social structure, and also wrote about other peoples living in the steppe beyond the Scythians. Herodotus has always been somewhat controversial. Since his own time, people have cast doubt on whether he actually visited half the places he said he did, and criticized him for including obvious myths rather than sticking to the facts. There are critics who have held up his writings on the Scythians as exemplars of Herodotus being a liar who made everything up, arguing that the descriptions of the steppe are completely untrue and without foundation. In the episode after the next one, we will be looking at what Herodotus wrote about the Scythians and Sarmatians, why critics have argued that it was all invented, and why they are entirely wrong, and in this case, Herodotus was actually surprisingly accurate. But before we get to that, in the next episode, we will go back to the Korgans and look at how the Scythians, the first steppe empire, were rediscovered in the expanding Russian Empire. This episode will bring to a close a little series on what you might think of as the precursors of our story. I hope that you formed a picture of life on the steppe and where it is in relation to its neighbours. Over the coming episodes, we're going to be going deeper into the formation of steppe culture, which will in many ways remain consistent from the Scythians through to the Mongols. We will be looking at what made them such fearsome warriors, capable of defeating almost anyone they came up against until firearms radically changed warfare, their migrations out of the steppe into the East European plain, and the early states formed by Turkic and other peoples in what is now southern Russia. Please follow or subscribe on the podcatcher of your choice and share with your friends. If you would like to help support this podcast, please consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Podchaser, or GoodPods. You can reach me on Twitter, Facebook, or at hello@therussianempirehistorypodcast.com. Thank you for listening, and I hope you will join me next time.